It's Yankee Yarn Time. Time to hear another story of New England, presented by Alden Hall Blackington and brought to you by the friendly First National Stores, New England's largest retailer of fine food.
Good evening. When I went down to Marblehead a few weeks ago to check up on the history of the painting Spirit of 1776, I bumped into Finn Williams on the way to bail out his boat, and we got to gabbing about the weather we've been having. Hot as blazes one day, cold and raw the next. And Finn said, "Say, when you were telling us about the cold year of 1816, I hoped you'd say something about George Crowninshield's yacht, Cleopatra's Barge, getting caught in the ice in Salem Harbor that year. You know, Blackie, Cleopatra's Barge was the first American yacht ever to poke her nose into European waters and foreign affairs, and the second yacht ever built in this country. The first yacht," Mr. Williams went on, "was the Jefferson, also built by Crowninshield in Salem. I think a story about these two first American yachts and the man who built them would make a swell Yankee yarn." That seemed like a good idea, so I started browsing round to see what I could find out about early American yachts and the Crowninshields. And I found so much, I hardly know where to begin. In his book, Yachting in America, Lewis Herrischoff says, "The first craft of any importance in this country was the Diver, built by John C. Stevens in 1809. In American yachts, J.D. Gerald Kelly adds, "John C. Stevens, Esquire, can be regarded as the father of American yachting. But in the records of Massachusetts Bay, we find that in 1801, which was 8 years before the Diver was built, Captain George Crowninshield, Jr. of Salem, built a sloop of 22 tons that he used as a pleasure yacht. This first American yacht was named the Jefferson. She was a fast sailer, and when the War of 1812 broke out, she was commissioned as a privateer. Recently, through the courtesy of Mr. Francis B. Crowninshield of Marblehead, I have had an opportunity to see the Jefferson's original papers, her commission signed by President Madison, various inventories, roster of officers and men, and one of the cannon that she carried in the War of 1812. Mr. Crowninshield showed us the cannon on the lawn of his estate overlooking Marblehead Harbor, and then he ushered us into his library. A more fitting place to find the ship story cannot be imagined. It is, in fact, a treasure house of priceless documents signed by American presidents and foreign notables, rare books in old China, models and maps, sextants and clocks, and a gold eagle and a 10-foot settee from the cabin of America's second yacht, Cleopatra's Barge. Mr. George Crowninshield, Jr., the man who built the barge in 1816, was a brother of the grandfather of our host, and it was evident that I had come to the right man to get my story. Pointing to a long panel-like painting over the door, he said, "There is the Crowninshield wharf in Salem as it looked during the embargo of 1808. It's a copy of the original painting by George Ropes, now in the Essex Institute. Only 8 of the family ships are tied up at the wharf, but the 2 at the end are worth looking at closely, the Fame and the Privateer America. We had 4 Americas in our fleet at one time or another, and it was in the America Third that my great-uncle brought back from India the first elephant ever seen in the United States. Quite a sensation for those days." I turned to Mr. Crowninshield and said, "Haven't I seen that picture in some magazine?" "You sure have," he said, "in Fortune. They did an article on the Derby family. Not being able to find a picture of the Derby wharf in its heyday, they used our wharf. Folks are always getting the Crowninshield Derby wharves, ships, and families mixed up. George Crowninshield Sr., the father of the man who built Cleopatra's barge, married Mary Derby. And her brother Elias Derby married George Crowninshield's sister. You see what I mean? I guess everyone knows how closely the Crowninshield and Derby families are interwoven with the history of old Salem and the development of foreign commerce. Those grand old Yankee merchant princes lived in magnificent mansions. Their big fast fleet scoured the ports of the world to get perfume and pepper, spices and sandalwood. Their warehouses bulged with bales of silk and satin and barrels of rum and molasses. On all these things, the Crowninshields and the Derbys made millions. They lived like kings and queens. But if you think they just sat around in their fancy clothes and powdered wigs, drinking imported wines from gold-rimmed goblets while the money poured down the chimney into their laps, you're mistaken. It was by ability, courage, and personal initiative that these Salem merchants achieved their success and social standing. What they got, they earned. Let me tell you how the Crowninshield boys, for instance, were prepared for a life of luxury and ease. There were 6 of them, including George Jr., who later built Cleopatra's barge. Old George Sr. insisted that every one of his sons should have what was then called a mercantile education. In other words, they had to be thoroughly trained in all that pertained to commerce, from the menial duties of the common sailor to the responsibilities of a captain. After all that had been mastered by several years of hard, dangerous personal sacrifice at sea, then they could come ashore and learn everything pertaining to the counting house and its management. Education like that is unknown today. The 6 Crown and Shield sons were sent to public school until they were 11 years old. They were then taught all about ships, sails, rigging, pumps, the weather, and navigation. And at the advanced age of 12, 13, or 14, they packed their bags and went to sea. As most of the merchants built and owned their own vessels, no man was thought fit to be a merchant until he had worked his way up from the hawse hole to the quarter deck, the stepping stone to the counting house. While other kids ran helter-skelter over the cobblestone streets of Salem, stealing apples, breaking windows, and playing other pranks, the Derby and Crown and Shield boys were plugging away at navigation, at 12 and 13, mind you. And in order that they might prove that they knew what they were doing in school, they were required to write out all their problems in longhand. If their notebooks didn't resemble a steel engraving with spotless pages and neatly drawn diagrams and perfect penmanship, they did them over until they did. Soiled margins, blots, and hem scratching were unheard of. Each boy trying his level best to turn out a neater, cleaner, more beautiful logbook than his classmates. George Washington did the same kind of work when he was a boy, studying surveying. And if you visit the library of the State Department in Washington, D.C., you can see samples of George Washington's work along those lines. Like as not, the attendant will say, Washington was very good at this sort of thing. But you should see what the Crown and Shield children did up in Salem, Massachusetts. All but one of those Crown and Shield boys commanded a ship before he was 20 years old. In one winter, I'm told, 5 of those brothers were absent from home at the same time, all commanding ships in the East Indies. The eldest son, George Crown and Shield Jr., was one of the best-known skippers of his day, bold, courageous, and strong. He loved ships and the men who sailed them. And after he joined his father's firm, he took over the building and outfitting of the Crown and Shield fleet. So it's not surprising that after many years ashore, he should want his own vessel. It was in the cold, never-to-be-forgotten spring of 1816, when he was 50 years old, that he took the plans of his palatial yacht to retire Beckett, Salem's master shipbuilder. Mr. Beckett took one look. Are you really serious, Mr. Crown and Shield? Nobody in the whole world ever saw anything like this. That's what I want, Mr. Beckett. And remember, I want only the best. I expect to travel to many foreign ports. This yacht will be my home, where I shall entertain the nobility. The first timbers were hardly raised when a crowd collected to watch the construction of this strange ship. Week after week, they braved the biting winds to watch the miracle unfold. This was the summer of 1816, the poverty year. But there was no sign of hard times at Beckett Shipyard in Salem. Below decks, interior decorators trimmed the captain's cabin and the main saloon with a lavish hand. There were French plate mirrors, crystal chandeliers, thick carpets and velvet drapes. All the ship's chinaware was specially designed, and her silver service and furniture. We saw one of the 2 10-foot-long settees from Cleopatra's barge when we called on Mr. Francis Crown and Shield in Marblehead. It's a beautiful piece of workmanship. Mahogany inlaid with bird's eye maple and decorated with gilt bronze ornaments. The rich wine-colored plush is edged with heavy gold lacing. Captain Crown and Shield wanted to sail for Europe as soon as his ship was launched. So he had everything put on board while the vessel was still on the stocks. Her spars were on end, her yards crossed, her rigging set up. Even her sails were bent, and a mighty press of canvas she carried too. Studding sails on the foreyard, skysail, ringtail, water sails, and other handkerchiefs never seen today. A new patented rudder and horizontal windlass were the wonders of the day. Local lads stood goggle-eyed in front of the brass belaying pins. And old-timers vowed they'd never seen velvet-covered ropes on a quarterdeck before. If George Crown and Shield had camouflage in mind when he designed the color scheme of Cleopatra's barge, he was 100 years ahead of his time. The boss painter said, "Do you mean to say you want the starboard side painted in horizontal stripes of lemon yellow, red, and dark blue, first one color and then another? That's just what I want." And handing the painter the next sketch, Mr. Crown and Shield said, "And I want the port side done in green, orange, and purple. But instead of horizontal stripes, I want a herringbone design. You know, zigzag." Mr. Crown and Shield liked color. He always wore bright scarves and waistcoats, brilliant coats, and high Hessian boots trimmed with gold tassels. When he started for the shipyard in his yellow curricle with his pigtail flying out from under a big beaver skin hat, no wonder folks called him a dandy. In a way, he was. But never too dandified to rush into a burning rag shop or sail loft to rescue smoke-blinded workmen. Nor did he bother to take off his elegant clothes when someone who couldn't swim fell into Salem Harbor. He jumped right in after them, gold, lace, and all. After Cleopatra's barge was launched in October 1816, she was moored at the company wharf while her stores were put aboard. Then she was towed out into the harbor and anchored about a third of a mile offshore between the wharf and Naugus Head. Visitors from all over came to inspect her. Frequently, 500 a day, tracked mud on the carpets and asked foolish questions. But Mr. Crowninshield didn't care. He was having fun, displaying his beautiful and costly pleasure yacht. When a New York reporter asked him about his itinerary, Mr. Crowninshield smiled. I shall proceed first to the Western Islands, thence to Gibraltar, then follow the coast of the Mediterranean, touching at all the important ports, go round the island of Sicily, up the Gulf of Venice to Trieste, cross to the coast of Albania, go through the Greek archipelago to the Dardanelles, and if the Turkish authorities will permit, we'll visit Constantinople. Well, while the reporter was getting his breath, Mr. Crowninshield continued. On our return voyage, we will pass through the Black Sea by way of the Isle of Cyprus and stop at Jerusalem and Alexandria. I want to see the Barbary Coast and then strike for the British Channel and North Sea. We will then proceed to Petersburg, North Cape, Spitsbergen, and Iceland. From there, I plan to sail straight across the ocean to the coast of South America. And after visiting the more important ports down there, we'll head up the coast to Salem. Then, he added, if we get a break in the weather, we'll start next week. That night, the temperature dropped to below zero, and it stayed that way for weeks. Salem Harbor was frozen all the way to Baker's Island. It was early spring 1817 before Captain Crowninshield set sail on what many said was a mission to rescue Napoleon Bonaparte. Was that the reason his yacht was camouflaged? On some future Friday night, I'll tell you about the cruise of Cleopatra's barge and how she was finally wrecked in the Hawaiian Islands.